All right. So what's something you wish people knew about the strike going on? I'm seeing a lot of negative press attention, and they're talking a lot of smack about the strike. What's something you wish they knew?
That we're not that bad, and that they need to come out here and really see what it's like instead of trying to see what it's like on the media. You never believe what's on the media, because anybody can paint a picture. I mean, you can go to Wikipedia itself and change stuff. It's just as easy as someone to go home and go on the computer with the technology nowadays and put in voice effects. If you got my voice now, you can go and change it and make it look like I said something bad. So you just got to come out here and you got to see what it's like, and you got to talk to people and ask them, hey man, what's going on? They're talking about this on the media. I'm just coming to see if it's true. You know what I mean? So the media is just painting us a bad picture for no reason. We're out here just trying to have a good time and make something positive out of something negative. You see over there, everybody's striking, not letting these stupid-ass trucks in. We're trying to get money. We're trying to get COLA, pension. We're trying to get all that. And they're stripping away from us what we deserve.
That's awesome. What are some so you mentioned COLA and you mentioned pensions. What are the biggest issues for you? Give me like a... Because I know that COLA, pensions, and I think there was another, the two-tier system.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest for you specifically?
So for me personally, I just started. I got 3 years in here. And I know for other people that have just started, it sucks not making that much money. I mean, yeah, you see that UPS is making $40-some, $50 an hour, and people want to talk about how we're not skilled labor, when in all reality, how are we not skilled labor? And not just anybody can get in here. You have to apply to get in here, and you have to wait a long time to get in here. And when you get in here, you get 3 days of training on a job, or up to a week depending on the job. So if it's, that's technically skilled. If it takes you longer than a day to learn the job, that's a skilled job. So I think that with the amount of work we do and the amount of hours we do and the amount we bust our ass, I believe that we should be getting paid a hell of a lot more to put up with the bullshit we have to day in and day out at this place. And I'm not saying that some people are bad, some people are good, like some of the supervisors, you know what I'm saying? They can be cool, but at the end of the day, it's like they got a job to do and we got our job to do. And to put up with all the bullshit that goes on there, you know what I'm saying? I go in there, I got to put a hub to my stomach, and I got to shoot 500 plus trucks a day, you know what I'm saying? For what I'm making right now, that's not worth it to me. And for top pay of $32 for me to continue to do that or go somewhere else, unless I have 30 years, 20 years, and I go drive outside, it's not worth it to do half these jobs in here because they require physical labor, which to me is a skilled position because not a lot of people can do what we do.
What's some of the stuff management's doing to make the strike harder for you guys?
Management at our plant isn't really doing nothing. It's just Ford itself is just keeps on calling the police on us and stuff like that. So it just makes it a lot harder for us to park somewhere. Shout out to Club Canton, the owner. He's letting us use his spare lot to be able to park there. And Relief, Weed Shop, shout out to them. They're letting us park there. And obviously, shout out to the local 900 crew because we're able to park there too. So they're just trying to make it to where it's harder for us to cripple us in this time of need. And we're making a good thing out of it by getting strong allies. So I mean, they're trying to cripple us so we can tap out. But I promise you that in the end run, we're a big, strong family, and they ain't gonna do nothing to us that we haven't already seen, done, or heard of. So.
And what would you say is like the important part of being part of a union?
And should more people join? Brotherhood and sisterhood. If you got somewhere and you got a union, that's the best part to be a part of the union, because when it comes down to it, I've been at plenty of jobs where it's not unionized, and guess what? It is definitely a hellhole, because you do something bad, they can fire you in an instant. Let's just say I mess something up here or I'm late. The union can fight for me and get me my job back, or they can get that scratched off my plate. Like if I got a late or an AWOL and it was something going on and I just didn't have time, they can help me out. It's a brotherhood and a sisterhood. We're all a family in here. Like in this time of need, I've met more people than I think I have the whole time working here, and we're all just friendly to each other. I became friends with a lot of people I didn't even know worked here. They come, oh, I work at paint shop. Hey, what's up? Hug it out, you know what I'm saying? If you need anything, we got you. You know, and the union's here for everybody. They got stuff set up to help anybody and everybody. So we're just a big, huge brother and sisterhood, man. That's all.
That's great awesome stuff.
Final question is not really part of the interview. This is completely up to your choice. Do you want to state your name or do you want to stay anonymous?
I use my nickname.
Okay.
Chawhead.
Chawhead, love that.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it, Chawhead.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Greenhouse. I am joined with a full staff today. At least all the boys are here. So joining me, repeat co-host Josh, promoted from tech staff, we got John. We got four staff on the payroll now, so to speak. So the show will now be the four of us, including Sky from last episode. And we got a bit of a special episode going on today. We have Ian, who is a member of Metro Detroit DSA, as well as the UAW, who will be taking some questions from us regarding recent events. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing great. How are you all?
Pretty good, pretty good. Just got off work. Nothing too big.
Nice.
Yeah, and you know, I'm fortunately free from the tolls of not exactly free from labor on Friday, but I don't have a scheduled work schedule. It's all sort of self-initiated on in my part in terms of getting, you know, research done and all that stuff.
Jesus, that is terrifying.
That's the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
So, Ian, how'd you get involved with both DSA and UAW?
Well, you know, I got into sort of DSA and socialist organizing, you know, with the Bernie movement and sort of the excitement around his 2019-2020 campaign. And, you know, at that time, it was pretty clear that, like, the organized vessel for those politics was DSA. There really wasn't any other organization on the left that was ready to channel that kind of energy and build it into, you know, what we would hope would be a broader socialist movement. So when I got to university, I started a YDSA chapter with some of my friends there. And then, you know, basically 4 years of that, I, you know, learned a lot about just sort of organizing generally. And that was also where I got, you know, a lot of my political education. And one thing that we talk a lot about in YDSA is this idea of the rank and file strategy, which is sort of this political idea that comes out of the international socialist tradition. And, you know, there's a book by Kim Moody and DSA has a pamphlet about it. But the long and short of it is, you know, if we as socialists believe that the working class is the agent of change that has, you know, both the incentive and economic position to bring about change to our world, the most important thing for, like, dedicated socialists to do is to join the working class in specific workplaces where there is the most, let's say, you know, in the most strategic workplaces, in the workplaces where there's the most leverage. So it basically, the simple idea is, like, encouraging socialists to get jobs as Teamsters and teachers and nurses and in these sectors that really have the ability to, like, shove the economy down when they go on strike. And so as part of that, you know, I graduated from school. I had, you know, a degree in design and I wanted to be a designer, but nobody was hiring. And I wanted a way to, like, fulfill my political ideas. So I got a job working the line at one of the big three.
That's awesome. What exactly do you do? Could you, like, describe, like, a typical day?
Yeah. So, essentially, it sounds like the most, like, stupid, easily replaceable labor you could imagine. I work at a stamping plant. So there's a giant, you know, $100 million machine, that someone who makes, you know, some skilled tradesman feeds a bunch of steel into off of a roll, and the machine has these big, like, 75,000 pound basically dyes, like mold, and it smashes them together on the metal and cuts and molds the metal into the shape that you see on a car. So either, you know, the fenders and stuff on the exterior, or like the stuff on the interior, like stuff you might not see on the underside of the car, protective stuff. So basically any metal part on the car goes through one of these machines. And then it runs down a conveyor belt, and I stand there waiting for it to come down the conveyor belt. I pick it up, I turn around, and I put it either in some sort of a bin or a rack, depending on the size and shape of the part.
Now, that might seem deceptively simple, especially to, you know, people in the professional class who tend to look down on this kind of labor, but with repeatable tasks like this, especially in somewhat industrial conditions, this can get both dangerous occasionally, as well as it places strain on the body. Where do some of these misconceptions come from, and are these used to further heighten class antagonism and these kinds of like incorrect and disdainful views sometimes?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I definitely agree that it's like physically strenuous, right? Like, you know, my wrists and my shoulders and my back hurt most nights.
Right.
It's also like definitely dangerous. The metal coming out of those machines is like razor sharp to the point where it could cut you, you know, through skin, through flesh, through muscle, down to the bone, and you wouldn't even feel it until it like flopped, you know, flopped open.
Wow.
So the safety training videos were quite intense. But I also think, you know, part of the job is actually like very easy and simple, right? Like, I don't know, I think a lot of people get it into this idea that there's no such thing as like unskilled labor, which is like true in a way. You definitely do develop a particular way of doing the job that's either less strenuous or faster or whatnot. But it's also like, really, by my third shift, I had it down, you know? And that is sort of a necessity of our like model of production, where like you need a ton of these jobs that are by necessity like very easy to train someone for, don't really take all that much experience or training to do, because that's like the only efficient way to run a business. The second part of the question is also interesting. I think, you know, for us on the line, we pretty much know that like our managers and stuff could not do our job, like just would not put up with it. And I think they know that as well. They definitely, you know, they don't want us to go on strike because then their boss is going to force them to do it. And, you know, they like being a manager. They like walking around with a walkie-talkie all day and just looking over people's shoulders, right? Like, that's an easy, easy job.
Well, I guess, you know, kind of real quick, a follow-up on that. Like, what would you describe, like, the relationship with, like, sort of that middle management like? Is it, you know, is it hostile? Is it more so just kind of like there's that, you know, you kind of acknowledge that there's sort of this shared acknowledgement that the job is, you know, unsavory in certain ways that they don't want to necessarily deal with. So, like, what is that kind of, what dynamic does that create in the workplace between you and your managers?
That's actually a super interesting question, because it's a really deceptive relationship. Like, the managers, at least on the shifts that I've worked, are really nice, like on a personal level. You know, they'll ask you about your weekend and they'll give you a fist bump and they'll be super friendly. And then the second you let your guard down, they're writing you up for whatever, like, minor infraction, especially as, you know, it's like time to negotiate a contract and all of these things. Like, you know, all of a sudden they're like turning around, you know, they're smiling in your face and then behind your back they're trying to get you fired, right?
Right.
And it's this very strange thing. Or, you know, right, they'll be super nice, and then as soon as like something is wrong with the machine on your line and it's not like producing parts the right way, and, you know, an hour is going by with no good parts being made, like, then someone's breathing down their neck. They're super stressed. They're coming over trying to, like, figure out what's going wrong and, like, breathing down everyone's necks. So it's very, like, complicated and kind of hard to grasp relationship.
Okay.
And it's effective for them, too, because then it's like, you know, I'm talking to my coworkers trying to, like, organize on the floor, and they're like, yeah, but, you know, this guy's nice. I like him.
So it makes you, like, less likely to kind of, like, go against the management just because they're nice to you on a more personal level? Do you think it's that, like, do you think it's that strategic or no?
I think so. I think they know what they're doing. But then as soon as you get written up that first time, I think that all goes away.
Well, like, and you're also not, like, you're technically not striking against that manager per se, right? It's against, you know, certain people higher up on that. But do you think that having that more amicable middleman is sort of, does that undermine, like, organization efforts?
It definitely can, because, like, you know, you might not go to your steward about something if you perceive that your manager is, like, a good guy who is going to, you know, try his best to fix your problem, right? Or you might not, you know, get your coworkers to, like, take an action together because if they don't see it that way. But I also think you can really only fake it so much. And people who have been in the plant for a little while, like, see right through it.
Sure.
Yeah, that's something that gets obscured a lot. And I think, like, management as it exists today is this industry in of itself, you know, with management styles, management theory coming into the fold in fields like both business and public administration, as well as this kind of, like, mystified role of managers as leaders in the workplace. It tends to create this, like, you know, self-mythologizing effect of the manager in the workplace that I think people don't, you know, not for bad reasons, sometimes may buy into. So there is that aspect to it. But it also, the creation of managers as they exist in the modern workplace, I feel like further obscures the real relationship between the C-suites, so the people at the top who are really eating the cream off of the crop, and the guys working the line. And that's really what it comes back down to in all labor struggles, I would feel. But people tend to more intimately feel it as a guy on the line versus manager struggles. And those are the ones that are often exacerbated in tales told by anti-union people I've seen.
And I think, you know, I think Barbara Ehrenreich had this, like, kind of almost prophetic idea in, like, the early 2000s of, like, the professional managerial class as this distinct social entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are ways in which that is, like, really, really true. Like, I totally agree with this framing of, like, the industry of creating managers as a huge, like, multi-billion-dollar industry, right? Including, like, academia and all these, I mean, down to, like, grind set YouTubers, right? Like, that's all part of the same, it's all part of the same network. But also then you have, like, the actual experience of these managers. Like, I don't know, this hasn't been my experience, but I've heard from other auto workers that, like, sometimes when they're sure nobody's listening, the manager will tell you, like, yeah, I hope you guys win and get a really good contract, because that means I'll probably get a raise, you know?
Wow.
Like, I mean, you know, these guys are making, like, money, but they're not, like, driving Porsches.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, like, now that we're talking more about, like, the structure of production, how the C-suite is kind of taking everything off the top. To rein this in, to talk about the UAW and the pickets, what were some of the factors kind of leading up to the strike? What were some of the conditions for the auto workers, union and non-union as well? Just kind of explain kind of what's been going on, what kind of led up to the strike.
I think we also had a major update today.
Yeah.
I think the first thing to understand, if you want to understand like the current, environment in automotive production, is sort of this history of reform in the UAW. Walter Reuther, who was like, the first or second president of the UAW in the 30s, was president for like 80 years up until his death. Up until the day he died, he was president of the UAW. And in that time, he created this structure called the Administration Caucus, which was basically like, if you want to be in leadership at all, you're going to like get in line, you know, and follow orders. And I guess kind of predictably over decades and decades, that devolved into the UAW that, you know, I guess we would have seen on the news a couple years ago, where like senior officials are getting indicted for corruption and, you know, people are getting caught using union and like member dues to rent 18 wheelers to haul back their like, you know, their souvenirs from golf trips to Florida. Like, you know, just sort of the most comical, like corrupt mismanagement that you could imagine from some like far right anti-union publication was all happening in the UAW. And then as part of this, like leaders and officials were taking straight up bribes from the companies, especially Stellantis, in order to like negotiate worse contracts. So auto workers right now, like when you factor in inflation and stuff, are making much less than they were like 30 years ago. You know, we have a thing called tiers, where some workers who are doing the exact same job in the exact same place, or maybe in a different factory, will have a different maximum pay, different retirement benefits, different healthcare, like completely different pay and wages from someone else just because they were hired at a later date, or work in a factory that's under like a different subsection of the company, even if they're doing the exact same work. Right. So like this degradation of working conditions created space for reformers, people who had like spent decades carrying out the rank and file strategy. It kind of goes back to that for me a lot.
Right.
It created the space for these many of them socialist militants, others just like dedicated unionists, to build a reform movement in the UAW. So in 2019, they created this caucus to oppose the administration caucus. It's called Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD. And the first thing they were trying to do was like pass motions at, you know, different locals to support one member, one vote, right? Like the direct election of the leadership. And then they were like having a little bit of progress with that, but then COVID happened, I think, and that sort of slowed them down until all of these leaders luckily got indicted on corruption charges, and the federal government was like, listen, we can either like basically shut down the UAW, or you can hold a referendum on if members want direct elections of leadership. And so that really, you know, like, I mean, this is, I guess, sort of how we should understand the way reform and change happens in our society, right? Like you have organized militants, and you have like some random change to conditions that comes from completely outside of their control. And like, you know, with the confluence of those two factors, all of a sudden there was a huge, huge, huge push to make sure that this referendum passed. And then when it did pass, UAWD was ready to put forward the Members United slate, which includes, you know, more than like a majority of the current International Executive Board, including, you know, President Sean Fain, Secretary Treasurer Margaret Mock, a couple of the vice presidents, like you know, and so that, wow, I'm going on for a long time here. I really apologize.
No, we appreciate information.
Yeah, we love this.
You know, that new leadership came in with this expectation from the membership that they would fight to do things like end tiers and win huge raises and, you know, put the fight back in the labor movement and bring the UAW back to like its militant origins. And so I guess that's sort of the whole picture of like how we get to this unprecedented, like first time ever strike at all three major automakers.
That's awesome. So you did mention the tier system as well as fighting for higher raises. Can you go more in depth about the tier system as well, but also other demands that the union is having?
Yeah, tiers is a really, really pernicious one. You know, my comrade Chris Viola has a Jacobin article that you can go find where he really tries to map out like how many different tiers exist just at GM at this point. Because there are obvious ones, right? There are workers who are considered tier one, and that's like any full-timer who was hired before 2007 or 2008 or something like that. And then there's tier two, which is any full-time worker who was hired after that. But then there are things like GMCH and CCA, which are like sort of subsidiaries of GM that handle aftermarket, you know, repair parts, distribution, and things like that. And workers there, you know, whereas workers like tier two workers in a main plant would max out maybe at like 30 or 40 something dollars an hour. Workers at these other plants, again, doing like the exact same thing, might max out at like 25. Right. And then you have people like me. I'm what's now called a supplemental employee, but was at different times called like a temporary worker or a temporary part-timer or something like that. Mm-hmm. I make much less than that. I make like $15.78. And so, you know, that's kind of what tiers is. But then you have this other, I mean, one of the big things in connection to that is pensions. Tier one workers get pensions. Nobody else gets a pension, right? And a defined benefit pension is a lot better than a 401k because, you know, the amount you get when you retire is not dependent on the state of the market at that time, right? You know, retiree health care. When you retire as a tier one person, the company has to keep paying for your health insurance until you die, right? And like when you're old, you probably have a lot of health expenses. You know, tier two and onwards workers don't have that. So that's. A lot of the demands are really wrapped up in this bigger question of tiers, right? Like, in order to really get rid of tiers, we have to win a lot of these demands for a lot of people. In terms of other demands, obviously wages, I think one thing that's incredible that the UAW has been able to do is like tie their demand for raises to sort of the class system in our society, right? Like, you know, the UAW has demanded a 40% raise over the 4 years of the contract. Coincidentally, in the past 10 years or whatever, big three CEOs have received a 40% raise on average. Mm. So like, you know, that's not an accident that those two numbers are the same. Mm-hmm. And I was going to talk about wages. And then there are also some, you know, bigger picture, like I would say like macroeconomic demands. I guess the big thing on a lot of people's minds right now in the auto industry is like transitioning away from fossil fuel powered vehicles, right? Like electric vehicles are the future and like more and more mandated by governments throughout the world and things like that. And the thing about electric vehicles is they have like way fewer parts, like 30% less parts. So you need 30% less labor to put them together, right? You know, auto workers aren't dumb. They look at that and they say, I could get fired. And of course, you know, if the green transition goes the way the companies want it, like, first of all, we probably won't actually mitigate the major effects of like ecological destruction, but also they're going to fire a lot of people. It's going to save them a lot of money, and they're going to make more in profits than they ever have. So as sort of a reaction to this, a lot of the, oh, and then another part of this is that, auto workers now are building these battery factories sort of around the country. But they're not doing them directly as themselves. So like GM is not building, GM battery factories. They are building, you know, Ultium battery factories, which is like a subsidiary that's a joint venture between them and another company. So because of that, they're not like subject to the same, you know, union recognition language that they would otherwise be. And so some of the bigger picture demands are like, you know, we want the government, if it's giving subsidies to encourage the production of electric vehicles, to ensure that the places that these subsidies are going are EV plants. Now, I don't think necessarily we expect to just be given that, but like, I think a successful strike right now could prove to EV workers throughout the country why they like need to be in the UAW. And then, you know, another part of this that gets a lot of attention is the demand for 32 hours work for 40 hours pay, basically a 4-day work week. And that's a direct recognition of like the way that EVs might cause downsizing in our industry, right? If there's 30% less labor that needs to be done, instead of firing 30% of the workforce, why don't you just have the whole workforce work 30% less?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, those are to me like the major questions. I mean, I think there's a lot wrapped up in this, but
and yeah. Quick question: was there a big difference between like the wage increases that UAW was fighting for versus COLA, the cost of living adjustment?
Oh yes, thank you. That is another thing. You know, one of the interesting things about this fight too is that like a lot of the things that we're fighting for and are being told like that's unreasonable, that's crazy, are things that auto workers used to have. So cost of living adjustment is a great one. Thank you, John, for bringing that back up. You know, with inflation and all the rest, like workers don't want to see their purchasing power go down. And so it used to be that every year they would do some math and decide, okay, you used to be making this amount of money. Here's what the same amount of purchasing power is now, right? And that your paycheck would get like automatically upgraded to match inflation. We don't have that now. So like, that's been a big fight as well.
That's awesome.
So some of the developments that have occurred today from Sean Fain's address is that they're getting a bit closer to a contract with Ford, but there's a lot that still needs to be done with GM and Stellantis specifically. So the next question we had for you is, are there any major differences among the individual players of the Big Three when it comes to how they treat the union and its demands? And are there any similarities among them?
There definitely are, but I don't know that I have a clear answer as to why. Like, I'm actually kind of baffled that Ford is playing so nicely compared to the other two. I just don't know how or why that is.
So Ford, in a statement, said that it's because they have a family-oriented structure. I don't buy that for a minute.
Yeah, bullshit.
Not just all. PR, yeah, like.
I don't know. I mean, it's not very like Marxist of me to say this, but like it could just be that they have different people at the negotiating table who think about this differently for some unknown reason. You know, like to me, it seems totally random. I don't understand it at all.
You don't think it like it has anything to do like it's not so much on your guys' end that you've done more harm or whatever to them to like, you know, force them to have to come to the table? Or
no, even before the strike, even as negotiations were like ongoing and the deadline hadn't arrived yet, Ford was, you know, like Ford would give a proposal and then GM and Stellantis would give a worse proposal. And then the next week, Ford would give a better proposal and GM and Stellantis would give the proposal Ford gave the week before. Hmm. Right? Like, it was very weird. They were just like always a step ahead. I don't know why.
Yeah, like a good cop, bad cop routine almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately,
I don't know. Maybe Ford wants good PR for bargaining fairly.
I mean, if again, yeah, with the Ford family's legacy, you know, they're always looking for good PR. They're always fishing for it.
Yeah.
That's my.
You're searching for anything that doesn't, you know, start with an H.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately. Okay, so you did go in depth with the union demands. I guess what's different about today's auto industry and its form of anti-union tactics? Do business strategies like the push to electric vehicles or needing to make up for slower sale years due to the pandemic impact their hostility to unions in addition to existing anti-labor mindsets in the C-suites?
Hmm. Good question. You know, it's sort of a multifaceted approach they have. On one side, a lot of it is that I think the companies have gone a long way to sort of encourage like a business unionist mindset or like a mindset of partnership between the company and the union. You know, all of my training, all of my sort of onboarding, whatever, like filling out an I-9 was done jointly between the company and the union. So like, we would be in the classroom doing like a safety lecture, and it would be like the health and safety committee man from the UAW, and then like someone who's basically like a safety manager, right? And they would be doing this together, and then, you know, because my local is like maybe a little bit more militant than most, like the management side one would leave the room for a second. And the union guy would be like, he's not your friend, you know? Nice. But I think in a lot of places, there's been this relationship built that, like, in some ways, management and the union can be hard to tell apart until there is, like, a contract fight or a strike. So I think that's kind of one tactic. And then the other tactic has just been, like, you know, this sort of creating these non-union battery plants and, you know, closing factories in the U.S. and moving production to countries with lower wages and lower labor standards. That kind of motion, or like even just trying to open plants in like right to work states where they think there's less likely to be like militancy and union organizing. Although that's kind of backfired because like GM's most profitable plant is in Arlington, Texas. And it's also like one of the most well-organized and like militant locals.
Nice. You do love to see it. You talked a lot about the anti-union tactics, which was very interesting, but what mainstream institutions like the Democratic Party or pro-labor, quote-unquote, I guess, institutions have been giving the UAW support? What's the overall response to you?
That's an interesting question as well. I think the Democratic Party and labor have a very strange and, like, sometimes fraught, sometimes friendly relationship. You know, like,
Real quick, I did want to add, there was a recent development, actually, like, literally minutes before we started recording, which was Biden tweeting out that he will be joining the picketers Tuesday.
Oh, really? Ooh.
Yes. I believe the same day or, like, within a couple days of Trump doing the same, which is going to be quite an interesting moment in Michigan politics. Mm-hmm. I think... yeah, like the Democratic Party and the labor movement are sort of, well, it's a beneficial relationship for the Democratic Party, right? Like Obviously, unions provide a lot of fundraising capability, and also are just like one of the few, to the extent that they are organized and whatever, it's like one of the few organized groups of people in the United States that continue to exist, right? Like, there are millions of people who are union members. It's not a huge, it's like 10% of Americans, but like, that's more than, you know, any other percentage of Americans in any sort of organization.
Right.
So there, it's, unions are important to the Democratic Party that way. And then as a part of that relationship, right, like the Democratic Party has to some extent, support organized labor. You know, in terms of like, you know, we see the Democrats in Michigan getting rid of a lot of the like nasty right to work and that kind of thing. We've seen Biden's NLRB be pretty good and you know, make a lot of rulings that have helped workers organize. And we see that, like, you know, a lot of Michigan's Democratic senators and Congress people like feel the need or have a genuine desire to like come out to the picket line and like speak at the rally and you know, voice their support for the UAW. So like there is this like somewhat friendly relationship, but at the same time, like, especially with like the reformed atmosphere in the UAW, there's a recognition that like, yeah, that relationship is a lot more give from the workers and a lot more take from the Democratic Party, right? Like, you know, there's been some hay made about the fact that like Sean Fain has refused to endorse Biden, you know, like until Biden gives like certain concessions to us. And even with Biden coming to the picket line next week, like, you know, there were a lot of questions like, why isn't Biden coming to the picket line? And Sean and others had said things like, well, you know, Biden's really not going to go to bat for us unless we make it, right? Unless we make it like politically infeasible for him not to. And I think that's what happened. Like, Biden announced, it's not a coincidence that Biden announced right today that he's coming to the picket line. Because on the live stream this morning, Sean Fain like challenged him to do it. He said, like, Joe Biden, come to the picket line or you hate workers, you know? Yeah. It worked. So there's an interesting dynamic that I hope to one day break.
Yeah, and talking more about Biden a little bit, as of late, he's been kind of flip-floppy on labor with the rail strike situation. And now promoting, you know, UAW now. What do you make of this, I'll say, interesting record of labor, Biden?
I mean, the unfortunate thing is when he, you know, goes on TV and says he's the most pro-labor president in American history, like, that's probably true.
Yeah.
I
mean,
not because he's super pro-labor, but because everyone's...
The bar is so fucking low, exactly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But I also think, you know... I mean, Biden has somewhat of a record of like connection to labor, right? Like he was at, you know, UAW picket lines in 2019 when there was a strike against GM. Mm-hmm. But also, like, I don't think you would see Biden or the Democratic Party being this, you know, supportive and behind the labor movement if it weren't for like straight up like Bernie, right? Like Bernie running for president twice and creating this movement that was not a majority, but this movement of that sought to like create an America that was, you know, if not run by workers, although I would say probably at least more supportive of and friendly to like workers and labor and like militancy against the boss. You know, we know that like unions are at all-time high approval ratings, right? Like, it's no coincidence that we have a president who is willing to go to bat more for labor under these circumstances than we did in, like, 2008, you know?
You think it's more of an advantageous, like, I don't want to say parasitic, because that feels a little harsh, but you think it's more of an advantageous, like, strategic alliance? as opposed to one that actually cares for labor.
Yeah, the Democrats have to care about labor right now in a way that they probably didn't have to in the past. They can't just ignore it. They can't, you know, yeah.
There was a meme going around on Twitter. I shared it with Josh where it's that one of someone looking really dejected after Bernie lost in 2016. They're talking to Bernie about, I thought we were going to change the world. And then the text is like deep fried and edited when Bernie talks. And the caption reads, bitch, we did. We in the seventh party system.
Yeah. Like, I don't know that I fully buy that, but yeah.
It was a joke, but I do have.
Oh, no, yeah.
There is a follow-up to this too, right? Where Trump has also flirted with union members as a potential block for the Trump coalition. He's never done anything pro-labor. I'm not fooled by any of it. But what do you make of this, like, half-assed overture from Trump to union workers?
It makes sense to me. I mean, again, for one, right? Like, unions are more popular than they've ever been, and like I don't know, I think one sort of cultural signifier that goes unnoticed a lot is that people just use the word workers now instead of like employees or like, you know, like another word that might fill that spot in the vocabulary. Like, the language of class is much more present now, which I think affects these kinds of decisions. But also, you know, it's Trump won more union members than like any Republican ever had, at least since, like, you know,
since Nixon, probably.
Nixon, yeah, exactly. And there is an interesting dynamic. I mean, you know, most of my coworkers are Black, and a lot of them are women and mothers and things like that. But then there are a lot of my coworkers who are like, you know, middle-aged white guys, especially skilled tradesmen, who, like, I don't know, I'm a white guy. On my third day there, like, some skilled tradesman came up to me and was like, good for you, we need more of our kind in here. You know, like,
yeah.
Straight up, like, KKK stuff.
I mean, and that was kind of the, you know, what sort of eroded a little bit of the, you know, union Democratic Party relation, especially, like, in the 90s, was just sort of that kind of stuff. Not that it necessarily justifies it, but it's, you know, it's, you know, it's interesting that you know, the more, you know, frankly racist sentiments are still alive and well in the
and you know, these guys love Trump, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we shouldn't be shocked. We shouldn't be shocked to find out. We should never accede to the fact that, like, broad sections of labor have been captured by sort of reactionary social politics, but, like, you know, that's the world we live in.
I guess looking at the Republican Party beyond Trump, though, we're getting, I think, a very different picture, especially, you know, there was, you know, the recent bit with Tim Scott where, like, if you strike, you're fired, and that's been reported now to the NLRB.
Yeah, he's in trouble for that one.
And, you know, how does, do you think that sort of plays this role in, you know, strengthening, you know, certainly the union coalition in a certain way? Like, how does the union respond to, like, that kind of rhetoric in general? Does it sort of strengthen your resolve to strike, or does it, you know, does it kind of scare some people, I guess?
I mean, to me personally, as a socialist, like, good, the class line is drawn, right? Like,
right.
You know, everyone can see who falls on what side. So I think it's beneficial in that way. And I also think, yeah, I think it, at least in the UAW, it strengthens people's resolve to strike. Like, people, auto workers have a sense, just from, like, cultural memory, of that they are in, like, a fighting union, you know, a union that strikes. A lot of workers in a lot of other industries, like, if you want to go on strike, you need to build a robust contract campaign and have escalating actions that everybody buys into and takes part in, and, like, you know, everyone's, like, organizing and thinking about fighting the boss, and you build up to this idea of a strike because people aren't, like, necessarily ready to just do it. But even when the UAW was at its most, like, sort of top down, like leadership directed, you know, dictatorial state. Like they would send out, you know, a message, you're going on strike at midnight, and 100% of the people in that plant would go on strike at midnight, you know? So when someone like Tim Scott says, like, you strike and you get fired, you know, like, people look around and just like, fuck you.
Right.
Right, yeah.
My parents went on strike. My grandparents went on strike. Blah, blah, blah. That's why I have, you know, that's why I make double time on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
It's your family tradition around here.
Exactly.
So I know we mentioned it. I know we mentioned it a couple of times throughout this. But what were actually the recent developments? I know we mentioned the live stream. Can we talk about exactly what was said?
Yes. So the UAW is following this strategy that they've come up with, and they're calling the stand-up strike, right? And the idea is that they're going to strike all three companies at once, but they're going to like pick and choose different workplaces that they find to be strategic. And, you know, with little to no notice, these different workplaces are going to be called out on strike. And I think this is good because, like, a lot of times if you have a big strike, right, you get everybody out on strike on day one, and then you put all your cards on the table, right? And there's a lot of power in that, certainly, like, all production stops. But at the same time, you can't go anywhere from there. You know, with this idea, like when the deadline first hit, only three workplaces were put on strike. They were pretty big. They were places that made, like, you know, very profitable vehicles, like the Bronco and the Wrangler. But, you know, there was the majority of the union was still at work. But, you know, with not enough progress made from last week to this week, now Sean Fain can go on a live stream and announce that 38 more workplaces are going to go on strike. So, you know, we went from three picket lines in three states to 41 picket lines in like 20 states or something like that, right? Like immediately just like building, you know, raising the temperature and jumping up to this like national strike. Even though probably the majority of workers are still at work. It also, you know, like the strategicness of it is pretty key. Obviously the first plants were targeted because they had a lot in common in terms of what they produced and like the profit margins there and how much it would hurt economically. And the same is true today. All the places that were called out were parts distribution centers. So when your car breaks down, if you take it to a dealer, they need to get a replacement part and they need it fast. So they have warehouses throughout the country that have all these replacement parts and they can just, you know, zip over there and get the part basically, or the warehouse drives it to the dealership. And these parts are, you know, pretty cheap for the company to make. It doesn't take a lot of workers to move them around. It doesn't cost them much essentially. And they can charge, you know, anyone who's ever gotten their car fixed at a dealership knows that they charge just like the most ridiculous money you can imagine for these parts.
Right.
So it's super, super high profit for the companies. And it's super low risk for the union because like it's really not that many workers. But by calling out, you know, whatever, another 20,000 workers from these, I don't know what the exact number is, I'm making that up, but like by calling out the workers from these locations, they're able to like cripple this really profitable supply chain because now none of these parts can go to dealers. They're stuck. So I don't know. That's the development, I think. We can get more into it if you have more specific questions.
No, I think that's good as a very big picture one. I'll go with the last question on the outline, and then, John, you can start fielding questions from your stream if there are any. So there seem to be certain strains of defeatist thought I tend to encounter where the current strike wave we've been experiencing post-COVID especially is not necessarily a cause for celebration. But I do think it's somewhat realistic to admit we're in a wave of renewed labor organizing and labor militancy. So this is a very broad and far-reaching question, but what predictions about labor conditions, militancy, and organizing could you make at this time, if any?
That's a good question. And I like your framing about the defeatist thing, because I think there are a lot of people, especially on the left, who have been so accustomed to losing for so long that they wouldn't know what winning looked like if it like came up and smacked them in the face. I think we are certainly in a moment of like renewed militancy, you know, from reform movements in the Teamsters and the UAW winning to the really robust contract campaign that the Teamsters put forward. I mean, I personally, as like an armchair, you know, I try not to be an armchair quarterback, but I think they would have won so much had they actually gone on strike there. But that was the nature of the coalition that won in the Teamsters. So this strike, and, you know, I think that a strike has a lot of power in a couple different ways. Like, you know, obviously you're extracting stuff from the capitalist class, and you're making them, you know, give you concessions, and you're halting production and stopping their flow of profits. But it also has like a huge psychological effect on society as a whole, right? Like, you can't turn on the radio or turn on the TV or, you know, go online without being barraged by photos and commentary and discussion about the strike, right? And like, even when it's like Mary Barra going on TV and saying like, they're so greedy, they're asking so much, it's like, you're still talking about the strike, right? And so I think the effect of that and the ripple effect it'll have of like raising the expectations of workers throughout this country, I think we'll hopefully continue to see that for years to come, because it's like, that to me, that is like the hope of reigniting the fire of class struggle, and like, from a socialist perspective, giving us a sea to swim in, a movement to be a part of, and a power, a base to build from.
That's awesome. Yeah, we talked about, you just specifically were talking about the psychological aspect of society. I guess my very last question is, in terms of like a ratio of support to not support at all, what do you think the general public's like feel for the current strike?
Well, the two polls we have, there was a Gallup poll and then there was another poll that came out the other day, both showed that like 75% of Americans support the strike. I would be surprised if the strike is still ongoing in 2 weeks if it's that high. I think there will be people who will be mad that they couldn't you know, buy the car they wanted, or the car they ordered came late, or like, I think that number will grow, and that's natural. But I mean, I think broadly society is much more supportive of like workers fighting for what they deserve than it's ever been, at least in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Josh, any final questions?
No, that's it for me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, sort of, you know, kind of following on a little bit of the theme with what Adi was asking is, you know, I guess to the extent that, you know, what do you sort of foresee, you know, the conditions of, you know, sort of labor coalitions, in the future, right? You know, we've seen, you know, obviously the UAW, but there's also, you know, stuff at Amazon, was it Starbucks as well, even, like, there's a lot of, like, these different groups. Do you think that we're going to see inroads in areas where we didn't necessarily expect unions to rise and stuff like that? And I guess just what are your just general, you know, sentiments about the future?
Yeah, I think and hope so. I mean, I think if we don't see a really actually successful unionization movement at Amazon, like, we're kind of cooked. You know, I mean, ALU made a huge breakthrough in its first successful election, right? But since then, it hasn't won an election. It doesn't have a contract. Like, there's this internal conflict within that union. I think probably not unrelated to those other two factors. Like, you know, I also think, again, like this psychological reverberation throughout society, right? Like, when workers see that through organization and collective action, they can take back, you know, the profits and the surpluses that they create with their labor, like, things can change. And, you know, I mean, I'd love to make big predictions about what's going to happen. Will you know, a socialist bloc be able to split off labor from the Democratic Party? You know, like, sure hope so. But frankly, I think we'll see a lot of things happen that will, like, completely surprise us. And we will see a lot of really big successes. We'll probably also see a lot of really, really crushing failures. And it'll be, it'll just be a struggle that we have to be a part of and actively involved in.
Very good.
Yeah, this has been probably one of the best interviews we've done on the program this year. And thanks again, Ian, for coming onto the show and giving us your time. Before we start closing out, is there anything you'd like to plug in regards to how people can support the union or where people might be able to follow you on social media, for example?
Yeah. You know, I mean, number one, join DSA. It's the only sort of organization of socialists in America, probably in the past 100 years, that has any possibility of, like, becoming a mass organization and, like, building a real viable party and you know, combat organization to fight capitalism. I would say check out labornotes.org. That is, like, all of the best reporting on the strike and on labor organizing in this country and around the world generally comes from Labor Notes. And then I would also say, if you have money you're looking to put to good use, you can't go wrong finding a striking UAW local and seeing if they need help, you know, stocking some sort of a strike kitchen or things like that. But also UAWD, the Reform Caucus in the UAW, is heavily reliant on donations to function and to continue to be successful. So if you believe in, like, strong militant democratic unions, check them out, uawd.org. And then, I don't know, people can follow me on Twitter. I think I'm at the Purple Blade, which is a pretty lame at that I need to find a suitable replacement. Oh, that's sick.
Don't worry about it. Yeah, I love it. All right. I will have those links along with where you can find me, Josh, and John as well, as well as our show's social media links. This has been another episode of Greenhouse Gaslighting. Take care, dear listener. Solidarity with all those on strike. Take care.